couple of things I'd like to tell you about. We've heard some very nice talks already about the thermodynamics of membranes and their shape fluctuations and such. And what I'd like to tell you about today is a question about dynamics. So the work I'm going to be telling you about, of course, has been done by me and some collaborators. The collaborators on the theory side, this work started off with Fred McIntosh and I, and Tanny Liverpool, and now Mark Henley is doing some very nice calculations on much more complicated versions of the problem. And really what's interesting and what I hope to show you today is some very new, some exciting experimental results coming out of UMass and also coming out of Emory University. Mike Denon is also working on the problem too, but I don't actually have his data to show you. And should this interest you, most of what I tell you about will be summarized in these older papers, but some of the newer stuff, particularly Mark's work and the stuff coming out of the Eric Weeks lab, hasn't been published yet, but you should look for it if you're interested, because that should be out sometime this summer. So the main point is that we've heard that the story of membranes and interfaces can be summarized in terms of the geometry of these two-dimensional surfaces embedded in a higher dimensional space. But if you want to ask questions about the dynamics on membranes, really the point of my talk is that you have to be a little bit more careful and look below the surface. You can see this is a principle that applies in other fields of research as well. So this is essentially the main point. The other main point is that the actual calculations I want to tell you about is I'd like to tell you what force do I have to apply to some sort of inclusion in the membrane to give it a certain displacement or velocity. We'll decide which as we go on when we're talking about elastic or viscous membranes. Also, we can ask the question about the coupling between two different points in the surface. In other words, if I push on this particle in the membrane here, then I'm not only going to move this one, but I'm also going to drag this one around through some sort of non-local hydrodynamic interaction. So you can ask the question, what's the velocity of this bit over here because I put a force on this bit over here? So these are the types of questions we can answer. In fact, to do that, what we're really going to be doing in this low Reynolds number approximation or a case of no inertia, I have a simple linear relationship between the velocities and displacements that I generate and the forces that I apply. So I'm going to be trying to calculate for you some complicated tensor that tells me about this information. And although this picture hints at I'm paying attention to the molecular structure of the membrane, I'm really not. I'm going to be doing continuum hydrodynamics. So this sort of molecular scale detail is actually entirely missing in the talk. So we're looking at this in the limit of the problem as it merely an elastic or viscoelastic continuum. You might say, why do you care about the hydrodynamics? And well, there are a number of reasons, and my favorite reasons are that some of my friends and colleagues are doing experiments that require answers. So, for instance, Eric Weeks' lab in Emory is looking at the correlated fluctuations of bits embedded on an interface or in a membrane and trying to use that to pull out the viscoelastic properties of the material. It's a type of microrheology which people have thought about for the last 10 years, but now applied to a membrane rather than to a bulk three-dimensional viscous fluid. You can also do viscometry in a membrane, as the Zazinski group does in Santa Barbara. Mike Denon is doing related things by putting semi-flexible bits on the membrane, so rather than a stiff needle like a glass filament, instead you can talk about a actin filament on a membrane and ask about its thermal undulations. Tony Dinsmore has built little rods and put them on the surface of spherical droplets and dragged them around with magnetic fields in a similar way to what Joe's group does, and ask questions about how the effect of the curvature of the membrane plays a role in the dynamics. The bigger issues, in some sense the big game that I'd like to understand someday, is what are the kinetics of lipid raft formation in a real cell membrane? And what are the kinetics of the aggregation? What are the lubrication forces between two domains as they come together? How do transmembrane proteins interact with each other hydrodynamically as they're moving around? Does that have some role in their aggregation kinetics? So if you ask the question not as a thermodynamic issue about phase separation in a membrane, then it's merely a question of what is the free energy minimum. But if you ask the question about the timescales over which these processes happen, then you're forced to consider kinetics and hydrodynamic questions. So I'd like to be prepared to do those. So I'm going to describe briefly the calculations and then show you some experimental results and other things. But to show you the calculations, I'd like to define my problem for you. At least to start with, I'm going to imagine that I can shrink the z direction of the membrane down to an infinitely thin sheet and not worry about that. So I'm going to describe a displacement field which lives on this two-dimensional sheet, and at the moment it will be globally flat. I can bend it later if I choose, and I can even change its topology later, as Mark has thought about. So I can consider an in-plane deformation field of this viscous or elastic membrane. I can also think of a vertical displacement field. So if we think about Jumal's talk, I'm thinking already in terms of the Monge gauge, and I guess I should apologize at this point now, but I'm not using your clever mathematics at this point. And the new feature is, though, that we do have to look below the surface. Because of that, it means I have to consider fluid flows that are happening in what I call the subphase, the material below the membrane, and the superphase, the material above the membrane, which is probably an aqueous solution. There, I have to consider a three-dimensional velocity field, and I'm going to consider stick boundary conditions so that the velocity matches between the membrane and the fluids on either side. And I'm also going to assume that the velocity goes to zero if I go arbitrarily high above the plane of the membrane or infinitely deep below the membrane. So I have no slip boundary conditions on the surface of the membrane, and I'm assuming the velocity decays as I go infinitely far away from it. Given that, and given the fact that I'm going to work in an inertia-free case, so I'm going to consider things at zero Reynolds number, really all I have to do is write down a stress balance equation. The stresses come in a bunch of different forms. This big term here is, as you can see, a history integral over all deformations that took place in the membrane. I'm assuming that the membrane itself is isotropic, so I can describe it by two Lemay coefficients, mu and lambda. And for the viscoelastic material, I have to imagine that these things have some sort of memory function so that they remember displacements that happened in the past, for instance, which is what this integral is doing for me. And this is a projector which tells me that the stresses generated live only in the plane of the membrane. My language, or I guess my notation here, is that Greek indices refer to the two-dimensional membrane indices, whereas the Roman indices are the ones that run over the three-dimensional space. And of course, there are forces that would bend the membrane out of the plane. For instance, I put in a curvature type force. You could imagine a surface tension type force as well. In fact, in this talk, I'm not going to think much about this at all. So in some sense, this is a placeholder for all possible out-of-plane forces. The term which is important, of course, for me now, is there's the hydrodynamic stresses due to the fluid above and below the membrane, which drag bits of the surface around. So in other words, if I push over here, I can generate flows that actually drag bits of the membrane somewhere else. So I have to calculate those as well. And finally, if I want to ask about linear response calculations, I might want to apply a force of my own. I might want to imagine reaching in with my hand and putting a force F on the material and asking what is the subsequent deformation as I go. So basically,
so if you have an active membrane, that would occur there?
If I had pumps in the system, I would put them right here. So then you'd have to know something about the statistics of the pumps. Oh, yeah, thanks for interrupting. If you have any questions,
like you do.
Those are good too.
You have a force, you're integrating a force over time, and then you're adding a force. So
I am.
You're adding a force to a momentum, so I'm confused.
Well, I'm adding a. This gives me, this integral as a whole is giving me a force. But that force depends on the entire history of what happened to it in the past.
Force is not just the integrand, it's the entire.
Yeah, I don't. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, this. What do you call this thing? The bracket should be going the whole way around.
Yeah. So could you explain a little bit more the memory terms and what the physical interpretation is?
Yeah, okay. This is a set, if I think of a viscoelastic material, mm-hmm. then in principle, the system is going to generate a stress now due to displacements that happened in the past. So think about, in fact, you were here for the little tutorial I did on viscoelasticity.
Right.
So imagine again I made a strain in the past, and then I asked how the stress decays in time. Well, the stress remembers that there was a displacement sometime in the past. We solved the simplest problem, essentially a delta function displacement in the past, and asked how the stress decayed for a simple viscoelastic material. So here what we're doing is we essentially have that sort of physics built into here. In some sense, what I'm going to do is it's going to be a lot easier to work in the frequency domain because these convolution integrals will simply be products, though. So if you like, you can think of it merely as a way to do a bunch of different harmonic shearing forces on the material. But if you think about it in the time domain, what it's really telling you is that if I jerk the membrane now, the stress in the membrane will relax over some time.
Okay, maybe a more specific question.
Yeah.
So why is there a mu and a lambda for the...
Oh, so...
In one term, but only in the other term. What should I think about the mu and the lambda?
Oh, so the mu and the lambda are called Lemay coefficients. This, if you like, is you'll notice this term here is related to compressional deformations because this is a divergence of the deformation field. So what I'm asking about is I'm asking about two linearly independent modes of deformation. I can imagine pure shear modes that are controlled entirely by mu, and compressional modes or longitudinal modes of the material which are controlled by a combination of mu and lambda. As long as the material is isotropic on a micro scale, so for instance, if I have a two-dimensional hexagonal lattice, it has exactly two Lemay coefficients. If I have a disordered material that is rotationally invariant under the disorder average, I also have two Lemay coefficients.
Okay.
If I had a more complicated crystal structure, I might have many elastic constants and I'd have a bigger elastic tensor to think about, but I don't want to think about bigger elastic tensors if I can help it.
So that's basically just Young modulus and shear modulus in some sense.
Yeah, exactly. Except
there are funny factors of two-thirds and some in three dimensions, but they become they vanish in 2 dimensions. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. I still like to call them Lemay coefficients, but you're right, you can work them out as shear and Young moduli. Yeah.
I just one other is this equivalent in terms of how you're treating the rest of the membrane to parameterizing treating it like a potential that varies in time?
I'm not sure what it was in
the space and time. Potential field which varies in space. And time.
I see. So you want me to think of the displacement field? You want me to think of U as a potential?
The entire sheet, whatever the
Whatever
the interactions between the membrane and the proteins in the membrane are,
mm-hmm.
Can you parameterize the effect of the membrane on the protein, which is essentially a potential field, which varies in space and time?
I believe not, because the point is that if I had potential interactions, well, maybe I'm being too naive here, but if I think about potential interactions between points in three-dimensional space, if you tell me the configuration of the system now, I can calculate the potential energy of the system. And then I can take a derivative and calculate the forces between the particles and evolve them forward in time. Well, here, what I'm claiming is that if you really wanted to calculate the forces between the particles, you'd have to know not only where they are right now, but you need to know how they got there. You need to know the strain history of the material. So I would say it's not like a potential interaction for that reason, if I'm understanding your question correctly. All right, so let's see. I'm glad there are lots of questions, but now I've completely lost my train of thought. So
you're going to talk about the Newtonian fluid.
Oh, thanks. Okay. Yeah. So if I want to solve the problem, maybe you should give the talk at this point. So if I actually want to calculate the stress tensor, what I need to do is I actually need to solve for the Newtonian flow around it, and I know what that stress tensor is in terms of the velocity field, and I know that the flow is incompressible in the surrounding material. You'll notice that I haven't required the membrane itself to be incompressible, though.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how those interact with each other. So you might say, this looks somewhat complicated. How are you going to solve it? And the way I think about it, anyway, is let me look at the linearly independent normal modes of the coupled system of membrane and fluid. So you might imagine what these are. You can, for instance, force a shear wave on the membrane, which will generate, of course, a velocity field in the surrounding fluid. The membrane here is supposed to be the bottom of the box, and the little arrows are at least Mathematica's attempt at a vector field in three dimensions. And what you're supposed to be seeing is the velocity field of the fluid above it. And if you don't like pictures and you like equations, this is, in fact, what you get is the solution. This has been thought about by a number of very smart people down here. So this is not entirely new, of course. I think the combination of things we did was perhaps new, but not this part. You can also think about bending the membrane, which also has been thought about by other smart people in the past. And here you see the edge-on view of the membrane of the sinusoidal deformation. And you'll notice that here, of course, I'm pushing fluid up, and here I'm sucking fluid down, so I'm creating these types of rolls. And here, in fact, you see here's my sinusoidal height deformation. I generate a pressure field around it, but I also generate a fluid velocity moving in the x direction along the membrane here, and also in the z direction, and they're out of phase by exactly I, so that, in fact, where you go up, and then you go over, then you come down. So it's exactly what you might expect, and we'll see that this actually plays a role for some of the things I'll talk about. I mentioned the membrane's compressible, but the fluid isn't. So the final linearly independent mode of deformation of the material is I can imagine here, again, I'm looking at the membrane edge on, if you like, and here I'm rarefying a bit of the membrane. I'm sort of pulling it apart here. And as I do so, I drag fluid left and right and create a downdraft because of the incompressibility of the fluid. I'm essentially sucking fluid down here. And now here, I'm having a place where I'm compactifying the membrane. I'm driving bits of it together. So I'm actually creating this updraft. And if you like, you have this sort of like storm cell growing above the membrane this way. And again, if you don't like the pictures and prefer the equations, here they are.
Are there relations between the Q and omega?
Yes, well, let's see. There, I can...
Probably the result.
Yeah, I mean, this actually, no, the point is that I can wiggle, I can choose the deformation wiggle that I put on it, and then I can simply, if I increase the frequency, I'm simply speeding up the movie in this low Reynolds number picture, right? So the only thing that's happening is that because this is a zero Reynolds number result, if I rarefy this thing now, this fluid, even arbitrarily far away, knows it better start moving down. So really all that omega is doing is it's characterizing the size of the velocity field, because the omega is determining the size of the velocity field on the surface, and you have to match them. So there's no cleverness beyond that going on here. And that's simply a feature of zero Reynolds number hydrodynamics. It simply means that information in the fluid propagates arbitrarily fast. It's like near field problem.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So the background equation is unsteady Stokes equation.
It is the Stokes equation. I'm not sure what unsteady means, but it is keeping stress continuity in the fluid simply by saying the gradient of this stress is zero.
But the solution you have shown examples, they all depend on time, right?
Of course, yes. That's what I call this. So I guess what I mean, I'm not sure, again, I don't know what unsteady means in this language, but what I'm saying is that the fluid
changes
updates
its...
Yeah, okay, fine. Changes in time, yes. Okay, yeah, then
so
it
do you
is
have
exactly
problems?
That. I have all kinds of problems.
I'm worried about the incompressibility business again.
Yeah.
You have things moving at the velocity of light, or an infinite velocity,
yeah.
And that sometimes gives problems. I know on surface waves, on fluids, that gives if you do that, you get wrong answers.
Yeah, it gives you problems. I'll show you a calculation where we thought about a stick moving through the membrane. And there you have the same problems that Stokes had with an infinitely long stick, that you don't get a hydrodynamic drag that depends per unit length. It has this logarithmic term, which people realized inertia cuts off for you. So it's that kind of issue. But generally speaking, the experiments happen at a Reynolds number of like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, which means the cutoff due to inertia is going to be on centimeter length scales. And these things are happening on smaller length scales. I'm not sure, is that answering your question or not?
Well, I'm just thinking of capillary wave systems. If
yeah.
I look at capillary waves, and I do that, I'm going to get very, very wrong answers for stuff on the nanoscale.
Okay, well, let's see.
The velocity of sound comes in an important way.
Okay, well, I don't think we get very wrong answers. Let's find out as we go along, but it's something to be aware of then. Let's watch hard. So, given that these are the modes, what I want to do is I want to calculate as a first pass, let's imagine I have one particle stuck in the membrane. You can think of this as one transmembrane protein or one island of different composition in the membrane. And I apply a force to it, F, and I'd like to calculate what is the velocity or the displacement of this particle. I can do that by essentially writing the force as in terms of its wave vector components such that they build up in the right way to create just the force localized at this spot. And then by summing over the linear modes that respond to each one of those wave vector forces, I can generate the x displacement, which is, of course, proportional to the force in the x direction. And now you'll notice that there's two terms in my solution, one coming about because of the compression, and this is the factor of two or whatever you were talking about. The bulk modulus of the material is 2 mu plus lambda, actually. And one coming about due to shear, and this angular dependence is natural simply because the force points in some directions, so along some directions it's trying to generate compressions, and along others it's generating shears.
So that's a step function?
Yes, in Q space.
So
the basic idea is that what I'm missing is I'm missing the details of exactly satisfying the stick boundary conditions on the surface of the particle. I thought I invented this, but unfortunately Debye did this when he thought about colloids about, 70 years before I came up with the idea. But the idea is essentially to say that the integrated force on the particle is correct. In some sense, the zeroth moment of the force distribution on the particle is correct, but the higher moments are not going to be right. In other words, I don't put little plus and minus differentials on the force to make sure I get the stick boundary conditions right at the size of the particle. But what I do get out is I can check that I get the right solution, for instance, for the drag on a particle in 3D using this technique. And we can also check that we'll get a famous result from Safran and Delbruck using this result as well.
So you pick Q max so that it cuts off at high Q.
Exactly,
right,
you cut it off at the right. So the idea is that essentially the size of the particle filters the high wave vector modes of the membrane at this point. So what I'm saying is I can't ask the material to have deformation modes on scales smaller than the particle. And then by doing that, I can actually tune my cutoff in such a way as to get the right answer for the so-called point particle sort of solution. And then from there, I have an easier way to then do other calculations.
What about numbers?
I mean,
as I recall, for a membrane, the compressional modulus is enormous compared to the shear modulus.
Yeah.
So the numbers are so it's very asymmetric, those two terms, right?
Of course, yeah. So in fact, there's nothing. Yeah, this could be in principle, lambda could be very high. It depends what system you're looking at. If you look at Langmuir monolayers at low enough density of surfactant on the surface,
I'm just thinking of self-assembled membrane.
Yeah, in that case, you're right. Well, in that case, you might as well assume it's incompressible. So the idea is this: a general calculation for membranes, interfaces, what have you. And you're right, for anything of a membrane that you would be interested in this lecture on, you would probably say to yourself, I replace this whole term by zero because this is huge now. But for instance, some of the experiments that Mike Denon is doing on fairly dilute phases of a surfactant monolayer, the compression modulus is higher than the shear modulus, but not arbitrarily higher. So for instance, you can do the math and you calculate the single particle response. And let me just focus on the in-plane response, which I'll call alpha parallel. And again, it has a bit which is related to shear and a bit which is related to compression. The thing which is interesting, though, is to pay attention to this bit inside the logarithm. You'll notice that I have a new dimensionless number which has entered the problem. You'll see that I have the shear modulus of the membrane divided by the effective shear modulus at a given frequency of the fluid. Eta times omega is effectively gives me the shear modulus of the viscous fluid at that frequency. The ratio of these two numbers is actually a length, though. The reason it's a length is you have to remember this is a two-dimensional elastic constant, where this is a three-dimensional elastic constant. Between them, you get a length, and in fact, that length now is going to be, you take the ratio of that length to the size of the particle, the radius of the particle, A. Effectively, what it's telling you is that the drag on the particle depends on the particle's size in only a logarithmic way, in a subdominant way. This is very different from what you would expect from Stokes' drag on a sphere falling through a fluid, where in fact, out here, I'd get a factor of A coming in. And essentially, you could reason that by just dimensional arguments or power counting here. You know that, in fact, this two-dimensional elastic constant has exactly the right dimensions to give me the mobility of the particle. So I don't actually need it there. And this is the way it actually enters the calculation. What it's telling you is it's telling you that you're doing a type of two-dimensional hydrodynamics that's very different from what you might have expected, because it actually has an inherent length scale. So you say, well, what does that mean? What does this inherent length scale mean? Well, imagine sort of a thought experiment that's probably impossible to do, but imagine putting a big wall or a stick in the membrane and oscillating it up and down in a perfectly elastic rubber sheet that's immersed in the fluid. If I were to do that and there were no fluid around, I could create a shear wave that would propagate on forever with the same amplitude. If I had a jerk up, this like lump would just propagate out forever. Here, in fact, what's happening is that the amplitude of those transverse oscillations is dying away because the system is bleeding the momentum into the third phase. So effectively, this new length scale in the problem is telling me how, if I inject momentum into the plane, over what length scale does it bleed away into the surrounding fluid. So what you have now is you have a hydrodynamics that isn't just going to give you power laws due to momentum conservation, but it's actually going to give you exponential decays of velocity and so on, because you do stuff here, and that information gets lost because you're moving fluid, which allows you to radiate momentum off it arbitrarily far away into the material. So it's really hydrodynamics with a length scale. I'm going to call that length scale L0 for the rest of the talk. And it's easiest to think about that length scale if I specialize the problem now to a purely viscous membrane. So rather than think of a viscoelastic membrane where this is some sort of complex function of frequency, let me think of it purely as minus I omega, as we saw for viscous materials, I need the I in here, times a membrane viscosity, which I'll call eta m. So the length scale that I have is eta m over eta then. So you might ask, what is this length scale? As Phil was saying, what are the numbers for a reasonable system? And remarkably, for instance, in a Langmuir monolayer with area pressure, you can change this viscosity by many orders of magnitude. So this length can go from being tens of nanometers to being centimeters, which is actually a rather remarkable thing. Eventually, though, as you start hitting the centimeters, you have to be careful because you start hitting ordered phases of the material, and then a simple isotropic viscous material is not a good description. So I see I should move on here. So if I do that, I actually recover one of the results that is well known in this business. If I simply slap the I omegas over to the side, so now I talk about a velocity response function. So think of this as the mobility now. Then in fact, I see that my answer is going to be 1 over 4 pi times eta m, the membrane viscosity, times this logarithmic term, and this is Euler's gamma. And the plus minus 1/2 relates to whether I have the perpendicular or parallel drag. Essentially, this plus minus 1/2 shows you the limit of the approximation I made using this wave vector cutoff. Essentially, even for a arbitrarily small spherical disk, I have to think about whether I want the plus, the parallel, or perpendicular in this language. Turns out the correct answer is to average the two of them for a simple particle. So that just gets rid of my 1/2. And this is the result of Safman and Delbruck. Safman was a real mathematician and hydrodynamicist, and as you know, Max Delbruck was a famous biologist, and they were thinking about the mobility of lipids in a membrane, or for instance, proteins in a membrane. And what they said is, they said that the mobility, and hence the diffusion constant, depends on the viscosity of the membrane, and depends only very weakly on the size and shape of the particle. So what it says is, it says that lipids diffuse the same way as proteins, as you know, small busts of Abraham Lincoln, or perhaps even Max Delbruck. It doesn't matter. Which is very different from what you might expect. If you remember in three dimensions, I could, in principle, measure the size of an object by saying, what is its diffusion constant? If I know the viscosity of the surrounding liquid, I have a reasonable way of measuring the size of it simply by measuring the diffusivity of the material. Here, I really don't, because I have this very weak logarithmic dependence going on here. And again, that's related to the fact that information does not simply propagate, momentum doesn't simply propagate through the plane. Effectively, what's going on is that if I move a small bust of Abraham Lincoln or something else in the membrane, I'm generating flows that actually help coordinate and move a patch of membrane with it. So if you like, I screen the information about the size and shape of the object, and it's only retained in this logarithmic bit here. So it sounds like membrane hydrodynamics, in some sense, hides information on length scales smaller than L0 for that reason. So you could ask about the hydrodynamic interaction of two bits in the membrane, and we can do exactly the same sort of calculation. In the simplest way, you should say what I really should do is a type of method of reflections. I should put a force here, calculate the velocity here, and calculate the velocity over here, and now put forces over here to fix the boundary conditions on the small bit here and work back and forth. I'm just going to stop at one reflection, or at zero reflections, I guess. And what I can do is I can calculate the hydrodynamic interaction of one particle with another at some distance x between them, and I can look at this by breaking it up into motion along the line of centers. So I have two particles moving like this, or motion perpendicular to the line of centers, two particles moving like that, and by linearity, anything in between is some combination of these two bits of the tensor, which I called here chi and here I omega alpha, because I guess I was trying to be confusing. The point is that the answer can be written in closed form in terms of Struve functions, which, other than being Mr. Struve's bid for immortality, are mangled Bessel functions, essentially, that contain this length x over L naught. You might say, well, that's great. How does that ever matter? One way it matters is there are people like Eric Weeks and Vikram Prasad who are doing microrheology in membranes. Here you have a interface which is decorated with human serum albumin, and they're watching colloidal bits on the surface, their Brownian motion. In fact, they're looking at the correlated Brownian motion of these two bits. And by doing so, they're able to extract the mechanical properties of the interface. These slides I stole from Eric. Here, in fact, he's showing you that the distance between them is diffusive, which is just shows you that it's a viscous membrane. Here are the two particle correlation functions, which I don't really want to go into. I think I'll skip that too, and you know, given time, let me skip that. The point is that given our formulas, they should be able to take all their data for the interparticle correlations using our hydrodynamic response function and collapse them onto one master curve. So if you take different surface viscosities, which change by about a factor of 100, I believe, they're able to take their data here, for instance, where they have a high surface viscosity material. I've never done a slide with transitions, so let's see if this works. There we go. For a medium viscosity material, and then for a low viscosity material, and they can collapse these onto one master curve once you scale them by the appropriate surface viscosity, what I call the membrane viscosity. And then this is one of the situations where the experimentalists are actually able to scatter their points somewhere along the lines that we wanted them to. So this is, in fact, the hydrodynamic interaction that we predict. So what this suggests is that this relatively simple calculation gets the viscous membrane right, and by extension, I would assume it gets the viscoelastic membrane right. That's one case where you might want to use this. What it means is that you have a nice tool now to measure the mechanical properties of the surface. Well, Tanny Liverpool and I and Fred McIntosh were thinking, well, if this hydrodynamic interaction works, let's try another problem. So this goes a little bit back to what Phil was saying. There's something funny about the hydrodynamic interactions that you have on the surface now. So let's try a problem where we know there are funny hydrodynamic interactions in three dimensions. If you go to zero Reynolds number and you drag a stick through the material, people about 120 years ago calculated what is the drag on the stick. And I'll show you that answer in a second. We're going to do the same calculation, and we're going to do it in a very simple way, again, using linearity. We have a set of, we know how to calculate the velocity field and drag about a ball when I drag it in the membrane. By linearity, I could do it for n balls in the membrane. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up this calculation in such a way that I will adjust the forces I apply on the n balls to make them all move at the same velocity once I put them next to each other, to make sort of the stick into a shish kebab, if you like. And then I'm going to calculate the velocity field that I get for all those balls. So essentially what it means is that I have to invert some matrix, which is n by n, where n counts the number of balls in the system. And that's, of course, doable on a simple computer. So from that, what we're going to do is we're going to calculate the drag coefficient of this stick. And this drag coefficient is actually a tensorial quantity, because I get different drag if I move the stick this way or if I move the stick this way in the membrane. So we'll
How many reflections do you use?
To do this, I'm using exactly one each time again. So you could say that this is going to get bad when the particles are near each other. But again, we're protected by L naught is what the answer is. If you work really hard and try to do a second reflection, we don't think it's changing the answer much.
What's L naught again?
L naught is this length that comes from the membrane viscosity divided by the subphase viscosity or superphase viscosity.
Is that one reflection thing, is that equivalent to the Osine tensor?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the asymptotic? You gave these horrible functions. I mean,
yeah.
What's their asymptotic behavior? I mean, what are the power, you know?
Oh, they go to logs at short distances.
At
long distances, they decay like 1 over r and 1 over r squared, depending what direction
so
you're
going. So they're long, much longer range.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So actually they have experimental evidence of that here. So here is what they call theta. Theta is what I call perp. And that goes as 1 over r squared at long distances. And the rr is what I call parallel. And that goes as 1 over r at long distances. And that comes out of doing of looking at the asymptotics of the crazy functions as well. But this is actual data, so which is much more believable than crazy functions, I understand. So as I was saying, the reason this is an interesting problem to me is that the Stokes result in this problem points up the long-range nature of the hydrodynamic interaction in 3D. You'll notice
if you did this in 3D with your formalism, putting do you recover this Stokes?
Yeah, it's actually it's been done by other people.
Okay.
So it's called the Kirkwood approximation to the
oh.
of their other rod.
Oh, okay.
So it turns out just about everything has a name, and I don't know all the names of that one. I do. It's been done. So anyway, what Kirkwood and Stokes and a variety of smart people thought about is they said, if I have a rod that's arbitrarily long and I move it in 3 dimensions, I have this funny situation where the drag, first of all, there's a factor of 2 between moving it vertically along its axis and moving it perpendicularly against its axis, I guess. But you'll notice that the drag in either case is not simply proportional to the length of the rod, but it's proportional to the length of the rod divided by log L. So it means for very long rods, the drag per unit length is going down. So you might say, why is that? And essentially, it's a drafting effect. It's the way I think about it anyway. This little bit of rod here is dragging fluid forward, which is generating a flow down here, which is pushing this little bit forward too. So effectively, a long rod gets to interact with more and more of these long-range hydrodynamic interacting segments and help sort of drag itself forward. So in fact, this is where this log L comes from.
And
this
is no problem with general laws of extensivity and things like that?
Yeah, so
that
exactly.
Really can't be right.
It can't be right. And in fact, the reason it's not right is that this bit of rod here doesn't interact properly with bits over here. It occurs in a time-delayed sense, and that fixes it. And in fact, it's not really clear to me that the infinitely long rod moving for arbitrarily long times has a well-defined solution because of that. The steady state for an infinitely long rod may not be right. But the way you get around it is you say that I haven't been moving the rod forever, and I have to think about how that started the flow in the beginning. So at that point, it gets a little bit hairy. But the important thing for me right now is that there is this factor, what I want to call hydrodynamic cooperativity, because each little bit of the rod is helping to drag other bits of the rod. Does that survive in 2D? The answer, well, first of all, we can, by making shish kebabs of various thicknesses and lengths, we can study the length of the rod, L, and also the aspect ratio, which I'll call rho. So a large aspect ratio means a very skinny rod, and a low aspect ratio rod means something more like an American football here. And what you see, in fact, is that the aspect ratio for rods that are smaller than L naught is essentially the dependence on aspect ratio is essentially immaterial for the parallel drag and also for the perpendicular drag. But I start noticing the difference when I get very long rods. And this goes back to the idea that the membrane hydrodynamics essentially hides or screens information on length scales smaller than L naught. So it doesn't really matter what I do when I'm smaller than L naught to this thing or what it looks like. Its aspect ratio becomes irrelevant. In fact, to really prove that to you, let's consider the value of the perpendicular motion of the rod, moving the rod this way versus moving the rod this way. If the rod is small enough, I claim it shouldn't matter at all. So here, in fact, you see the perpendicular drag and the parallel drag as a function of the length of the rod, again, non-dimensionalized by L naught. And in fact, you see these two drags become very similar when I'm smaller than L naught, but start diverging as I get larger. So in fact, this is again the Southman-Delbrück idea that what goes on about the shape of the protein or the domain is immaterial as long as I'm smaller than L naught. When I'm larger than L naught, I start poking the rod out from its sort of screening blob and I start noticing what it looks like. So remember, this ratio should have just been a simple factor of 2 in 3 dimensions. But here now it's a length-dependent ratio because I'm actually losing hydrodynamic cooperativity as I'm changing the size of this thing. So one way to try to get at what's going on here is let's take the drag per unit length in the two directions. And we should have expected this to decay like 1 over log L if we had the old Stokes answer. But in fact, for the perpendicular one, there's no dependence left at all. These dotted points are simply a constant. And this is what I would get if I had log L here. So this is my 1 over log L bit here. And you'll see that for large lengths, the parallel drag retains the hydrodynamic cooperativity, but the perpendicular drag doesn't. And that's really the source of this splitting of these two curves here. Another way to see that is I simply plot the ratio, and you'll notice that when L is small compared to L naught, this ratio is 1 and essentially flat. But when L gets larger, then I start actually seeing this go as simply log L, because one of them has a 1 over log L and one of them doesn't. So if you think about it physically, what could possibly be going on here? In some sense, when the rods are very long, you'd imagine most of the dissipation is now happening in the fluid flow in the bulk. So something is different. Or another way of saying it is, if I go back here and I say I can tune down L naught simply by making the viscosity of the membrane arbitrarily small. So in that case, all the stress has to be carried by the fluid. So how is it still that the system knows about the membrane when the viscosity of the membrane is arbitrarily small? The answer is actually what I'm doing is I'm changing the topology of the flow by enforcing the fact that the membrane doesn't deform out of the plane. Think about the rod moving parallel to its long axis. What I have is, in the rod's reference frame, is I have fluid elements in the membrane approaching here and sort of going around the end caps in some way and then converging in the back. And in fact, what I find is that the parallel drag when the rod is very long looks exactly like what Stokes would have told me it should be, except this prefactor here that depends on the shape of the end caps anyway is a different numerical value. This is just comes from numerically fitting what we have. If you look at the other case, though, we don't get this sort of Stokes hydrodynamic cooperativity. And effectively, the reason is that when the rod is moving up, so fluid elements are coming down and impinging on the rod, there's no short way around the rod anymore. An element of membrane, no matter how unviscous it is, comes down this way and has to flow all the way around the long side here, simply because the short path requires elements of membrane to leave and go into the fluid, which is something we're explicitly not allowing. So no matter how unviscous the membrane is, this change in the topology of the system, the fact that I don't now allow flows in the membrane up or down, completely changes the nature of the flow field around the rod for the perpendicular direction, but not for the parallel direction.
I'm confused a little bit.
Yeah.
What about the dimensions of the rod compared to the dimensions of the membrane?
Yeah, so in our problem, we're assuming that
there's excluded rod.
Yeah, so the way we did the calculation is, if you were to really look carefully at what we have, we would have membrane like this, rod would be like that, and then membrane would be like that. So this doesn't actually give you information. So for instance, if there's like a keel hanging out down here, that's not in our calculation. The only thing I know about that is...
I see, so the rod on that outside sees the 3D fluid.
Yeah. So
that's what I was confused about.
Yeah.
It's not in the membrane. It's the same thickness as the membrane.
Yeah. Well, even if it weren't, though, essentially you'd have to imagine that, let's say, so I think what you're suggesting, Phil, is that what if it looked like that?
I was wondering that, yeah.
Yeah, so in that case, my suspicion is that we don't get a very different answer, simply because it's hard to imagine that the velocity here is going to be very different from the velocity of the patch right below it. So I probably don't care. The person who knows the answer best, actually, is Thomas Fisher, who worked very hard at looking at a sphere embedded in a Langmuir monolayer like this, where he thought very carefully about the contact angle here and about whether it's possible to generate rolling motion and things like this. And the answer is yes, you can, but numerically it doesn't change the results very dramatically. Now, I don't think he's done anything where you have like big bits hanging down, and that could change things in ways I don't know, but we didn't try that. Neither did he. Yeah?
If you move the rod to a given velocity v, I would assume that the flow field of the membrane would be faster by a factor which is the ratio of the aspect ratio. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. By area conservation, it has to be.
Exactly. So that means that at some point, if the rod is only long enough, you're going to go out of the low inverse boundary regime.
Exactly, which we didn't do. But that's an interesting point. So what Marcus is saying is that you have this problem with area conservation, that all the area here has to get to there when the rod moves, or vice versa. I don't know which way I'm moving my rod. So if I do that, this bit here has to go at a speed relative, which is proportional to the length that it has to go now, divided by the I guess by the velocity of the rod. It gives me the time it takes I need to get there. So if I move the rod at finite velocity and I make it longer and longer and longer, I'm forcing fluid elements to go faster and faster. And at some point below Reynolds number, the approximation breaks down, which probably is going to tell me that some very large length scale, this formula has to break down too, but I don't know what that answer is then. So it could be an interesting thing to think about. One of the consequences of this strange, purely algebraic drag on the perpendicular motion of the rod is that we predict that the rotational motion of the rod is actually going to be purely like L cubed once you get the rod longer than L naught. You'll notice again, Safman Delbrook imposed this idea of screening and say, it doesn't matter how long your rod is when you're smaller than L naught, but once you are, the drag should be purely proportional to L cubed with no logarithmic corrections. I probably have like 5 minutes to go, so I think we're probably okay. Well, I guess it's not real. I don't think I can actually get through a talk these days without mentioning semi-flexible polymers. So you could imagine you could take a semi-flexible polymer and stick it into the membrane. For instance, people are doing that, people meaning Mike Denon are doing this, by putting an actin filament on a Langmuir monolayer and asking what its thermal undulations are like. So we thought a little bit about this. We could ask questions about the decay of undulation modes at a given wave vector Q. If you like, this is the lower dimensional realization of the Lennon-Brochard problem of an undulating sheet in a fluid. So back in the 70s, they thought about a membrane which is undulating perpendicular to itself and generating these hydrodynamic flows. And they said if you simply have a bending energy in the problem, you would expect the decay rate of these undulations to go as the fourth power of the wave vector. Simply that's what you need to compute the bending energy. However, what you find is that it actually goes as the third power, and that's due to this hydrodynamic interaction between uprising sections here and down sinking sections half a wavelength away. So the same sorts of questions you can ask here. Is there a sign of the same sort of hydrodynamic cooperativity for a dimensionally reduced version of an undulating membrane? And the answer is actually it's a little bit more complicated because now there's a point of what wave vector are we looking at compared to L naught. If in fact you look at very small, what I've done here is I've plotted the decay time as it divided by Q fourth. So if in fact there were no hydrodynamic cooperativity here, I would expect this to have a slope of zero, as you see here. But if the Lennon-Brochard answer worked, then I should expect this whole thing to go down as 1 over Q, which is what this red line is the guide to the eye for. And you'll notice, in fact, that there's a crossover here from a 2D variant of the Lennon-Brochard answer to essentially a free draining answer, which is what you'd get with the Q fourth. So, in fact, here you have a system where L naught again rears its head by saying that you get the hydrodynamic cooperativity, but only for some of the wave vectors. So it's like you have a free draining solution with no hydrodynamic interactions in one limit, here where you have the Q fourth, and here you start having the hydrodynamic interactions, but only at the higher wave vector modes. The long wave vector modes, again, have this property of losing the hydrodynamic interactions. So I'd like to finish up with, in the last couple of minutes, with something new and different, so I'll skip the summary. One way you can actually explore these issues is you can build surfaces or interfaces with different different viscosities by cramming nanoparticles onto an oil droplet that sits in water. These images were all made at the University of Massachusetts in Tony Dinsmore's lab. So what they have here is they have small cadmium selenide droplets, particles on an oil and water droplet. And by tuning the size of them, you can actually tune the wavelength at which they fluoresce. The big ones fluoresce at longer wavelengths. So here, in fact, you can make the very expensive version of the pimento and the olive by having the larger nanoparticles aggregate here into a red drop on a surface that's coated with smaller green nanoparticles, actually. Well, that may be amusing for a picture. But what we can also do is we can track how these particles move when we put larger particles or rods on them. So here is an image of magnetic colloids that have been stuck together in a magnetic field. These are paramagnetic colloids. And the scale bar, I think, is 10 microns. What you see in this modeled background are lots of little nanoparticles that you can't focus on, which are actually crowding the surface and generating a higher viscosity of the material. And now, Ryan McGordy, who was working with Tony at the time, uses a magnetic field to drag this bar or this rod of bigger colloids around the surface of the droplet, and by following what the little ones are doing, you can calculate the flow field. So, for instance, here's a demonstration that you can keep track of the bar, and at the same time, let the computer find the small particles to calculate the flow field. What's nice about this is that you can actually calculate the mean square displacement of the small particles and use the Saf-Mandel book answer to calculate exactly what L naught is for our droplet, or a particular droplet. Since you can't actually tune that very well, you simply measure it each time and see what you get. So for instance, on this one droplet of 52 nanometer diameter, the L naught is about 13 nanometers based on these fits. Once you've done that, you can then use the advective motion of the particles to map out the velocity field around the rod. So for instance, the rod actually was sitting here in the center and drifting downward in the frame. And each one of these points is a position of one of the particles that the average of a small number of particles that the computer found. And then the head of the little line is where that center of mass moved to in five frames. So by doing this, you can build up velocity fields, something like this. I put in this black bar here to represent what the rod would look like. And here you see a velocity map around the rod as you move it. So essentially what they've done is they've dragged this rod up to the top of a spherical droplet which is sitting on the slide, and then let it fall under gravity, slide down the surface, and it generates this flow field. We can compare this flow field to what we predict experimentally. The red lines are our prediction with no fitting parameters because L naught's been fixed for us, and we know the length of the rod, so there's nothing else to work with. And the black is the data. There is a perhaps more quantitative way to do the same fits. In fact, here what we see is we see the velocity field in a slice across the center of the rod while it's moving, and we're looking at the velocity in the y direction, which is up here. We cut across, and the unseeable yellow is what is the theoretical prediction. This forest of other lines is what you would get if you changed L naught. And the noise in the data represents the fact that you have fewer points farther away, so you have incomplete averaging over the Brownian motion here. So you can also do it in other directions. You take slices like this. I think I've worn out my welcome, so let me just finish with one thing that Mark Henley's doing. What they've discovered is that the theory works quite well for the flow around a rod, as long as the diameter of the sphere is large compared to L naught. When the sphere diameter gets small compared to L naught, effects of curvature, I imagine, are playing a role. So Tony tried this thing where he said, well, if I take the sphere radius and I compute this strange geometric mean of L naught and the size of the rod, those are the only lengths in the problem, he claims this dimensionless number is a measure of the goodness or badness of the theory. I don't particularly believe these exponents, and these were done simply by goofing on the computer for a little bit, but the trend is clearly there. The theory works better when you have a big sphere, and it starts working poorly when you have a small sphere, effectively, is what this means. And you measure big and small relative to some combination of L and L naught, but presumably L is much smaller than L naught, so I suspect L naught is really the dominant feature here. So, in fact, what you notice is that the velocity field in the data decays much more rapidly as you move away from the rod this way when you have a small sphere. And I think what's going on, essentially, is that when you're trying to move a patch like a solid body around the rod, you're eventually running into the fact that this patch is getting to be the same radius as the rod, and you end up trying to create a lot of vorticity at the antipodes, away 90 degrees away from where you're moving the rod. So Mark Henley thought a lot about this. So he's done the calculation with the entire spherical geometry, calculating the fluid flow inside the sphere and outside the sphere, and then working out the mobility of a bit that you put at the North Pole and put a force on it. And we can now plot that result where we fix the size of the object relative to L naught. So the object is essentially a point force. It's a hundredth the size of L naught. But we play with the radius of the sphere R compared to L naught. And in fact, we get the flat result here when this radius is rather large. In fact, the data that we have is taken right around here, where it's about a factor of 10. So Tony's original data was somewhere here, and we probably couldn't tell the difference between that small amount here. But the ones where Tony noticed something was going wrong is essentially when you're getting into this regime here, where you're starting to get about a factor of 2 change in the mobility. And you'll notice that the mobility is going down. Effectively, geometry is stiffening the surface with no change in material properties. So I think this is something interesting in this. I'd like to point out that at some point, Mark Henley is going to give a talk about this here or some other time, and it's a much more complicated theory, but it's actually one that seems to show why small curve things act more solid-like than the bigger curve things, even though the material properties are exactly the same. And what it suggests is that if you want to think about the mechanics of membranes, geometry and material properties come in on the same footing in some sense. At least they have to be combined if you really want to know what we're thinking about. So given that I think I told you what we're thinking about, let me put up my summary slide and take whatever questions you have left. And thanks for listening for a whole hour.